Excellencies, members of the press, ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the GMAS High Level Roundtable 2015. We are delighted that so many of you were able to take time from your busy schedules to join us this afternoon. We promise not to disappoint. It is also a distinct honor to introduce today's moderator, a man who does not really need an introduction, but I'll do it anyway, a man of great stature, literally, former Netherlands ambassador to Ireland, Hungary, India, protocol specialist, and GMAS senior advisor, Erik Nie.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, you all. And the stature, yes, you know why the Dutch, we are now the tallest nation in the world. You know why that is? Not only that, and not the cycling only, there's another reason for it. About half of our country is below sea level. And when the dike breaks down, we have to be able to survive. So that's why we are so tall. Welcome to all of you here, and thank you very much for having responded in such enormous numbers to our invitation for this afternoon on digital diplomacy. When I started diplomacy, I think this was more or less not only a paradox, but a contradiction. But now, in these days, digital diplomacy is very much something which is there to stay and which will develop in the coming years very rapidly. Before we go into the substance of the digital diplomacy, I have to do one thing which I do with great pleasure, is thanking our sponsors. It's usual that we do that, I do it right away. It's Nieuwsport, where we are here now, the main Dutch press center, Mercedes-Benz, you have seen it, MacBay Translation, the Legalization Bureau, the American Book Center, you have seen in the hall as well, the florist, Alpina florist, you see, and the AOC hospitality team, which you have met when you stepped out of your car, as well as ABN AMRO. So thank you very much. We have one more sponsor, and that I will mention at the end of the afternoon, because it's a little bit special one. Normally, when you have meetings like this, people say, switch off your telephone. I'm not going to do that. I think in the digital age, the telephone might be on, but don't make too much noise if it goes off, please. For me to announce the speakers from the ones who will be joining you before the interval. And the first one is very much one of our main, the main news agency in the Netherlands, ANP, Mr. Guido van Nispen. You see intros on the biographies of all the speakers in your program. So I can surface with one line. He is the CEO of ANP, and let's listen what he has to say about digitality. Thank you, Guido van Nispen.
Thank you, Mr. Nie. Welcome, Your Excellencies, colleagues of the press, and members of the audience. It's quite a challenge sharing some ideas on what's happening on this mobile and digital diplomacy. Diplomacy, of course, is not the key of a press agency. A news agency makes sure there's unbiased news, and it's not a diplomatic institution. But I think you might learn some of our findings and what we have done to become more mobile in this area. And as Mr. Nie said, I am the CEO of the national news agency, ANP, and also of a smaller news agency called Novum News, which is more regional oriented. ANP started in 1937 with 71 newspapers as a conglomerate. And that is still our core. We serve virtually all the media in the Netherlands, and that is our, you know, the core of our business, giving them our news and information. And of course, being Dutch, one of the fundamental starting principles of a news agency in Holland is sharing cost. In a lot of other agencies in the world, there might be different reasons, but Dutch always are very cost conscious. So already in the 30s, they gathered that if we would do things together, it would be cheaper than do it by themselves. And that's the first thing. But the second thing, which is extremely important in Dutch society, and also remember the mid-30s when ANP was started, there was a very big need for unbiased news. And we have here in the Netherlands a huge amounts of media, and all of them have their own signature. Some are left-wing, some are right-wing, some have certain areas of ideas or responsibilities. But we as a news agency are the only ones that do unbiased news. And I think already in the 30s, it was shared that we don't have an opinion. And even if you would see our news feed, you will see there's no opinion. We don't take sides, and we don't try to explain what's going on. We state factual. And that is very important, because even in those days, and that's still one of our fundamentals, we believe that a good news service makes sure that your country and your democracy is as stable as it can get. But a lot has changed since the early 30s. And if we look back at our photo archive, which is always nice, you see, you know, old cameras here at the Binnenhof, for example, at Prinsjesdag. You must have heard about this event in the Netherlands. You know, in those days, we would have one photographer, they would make a picture, they would drive by an old car somewhere, they would develop it, and by the next day, a picture would be in the newspapers. And that was the heartbeat of the news in those days. Because that's what we supply, the heartbeat of the Dutch news every day. If you move to what we do now, and to give you a little bit of perspective, first of all, we operate 24/7, 365 days a year, so we're always there. And if something happens, you know, we report it and we inform all our media partners. We do about 160,000 articles every year. So we produce 600-700 articles a day by our journalists. That gives you a little bit of a feeling of what kind of heartbeat we're talking about. And you might ask, is there so much more happening in the Netherlands than in the 1930s? And the answer is probably not. But we have invented the computer, and the computer made sure that people get bored very easily. So they hit the F5 button, or they use their mobile, and they want to have a constant flow of new things happening and passing. And that's one of the big drivers, funnily enough, the technology to provide more and more news. And we believe this will even further increase. So the amount of news articles that will be produced is growing dramatically and will keep growing, just to make sure that everybody gets what they want. We do about 6 million pictures a year. So there's I think in the program, there's a little bit of a typo, is a zero missing. This is an incredible amount. And we get this from international news agencies, our partners like DPA in Germany or AP in the United States or EFE in Spain. And this kind of enormous amount of pictures gives our media partners the opportunity to tell every story they want to tell. If there's something happening on sports, on war, on refugees, you know, there's a wealth of pictures. In the Netherlands ourselves, we make sure that every important activity, we send our own people to take pictures, whether it's the royal family, the politics, or etc. But you can imagine 6 million pictures a year, and we keep about 11 million pictures in our databases, so we throw some away, is an enormous volume, and it helps the storytelling. But it also has some other aspects. When we had the terrible incidents with Charlie Hebdo in France, we had about 5,000 pictures in our database with a tag, so which somewhere referred to what happened there. And we got a lot of bomb threats and threats because we published them. And this is always a challenge for a news agency, because as we said, we are unbiased, but it means we still publish a lot of material which is open for the public. We also do all the radio bulletins for the commercial stations, and we do more and more video. Excuse me. But also importantly, we give the agenda for the media for the next 2 to 3 weeks. And it's not that we don't have an agenda for a longer period, but this is how media organizations work in the Netherlands. They have an overview for the next 2 weeks to schedule their reporters. So that's what we do. We do the elections. So if there are elections in the Netherlands, we do it at the day. And of course, we work together, as I said before, with all these international colleagues like AFP in France, DPA in Germany, Press Association in the UK, etc. All this has led to us that we are more and more an IT company, because these enormous volumes we have to produce and share make sure that we have to bring it to our partners, and our partners bring it further into the media. We call it our news turbine. all our news is read by approximately 80% of the Dutch people every day. So this is quite a substantial amount of traffic we're generating. And it also makes sure that we have to be very conscious what we send out. Because if we send something out, by definition, it's the truth. Maybe it's not the truth, but it's perceived as, and it makes us very conscious of what we send out. But it also makes sure that if you look at your diplomacy, you will have to be able to go through these huge amounts of data and articles that are being produced, basically, when you walk around. And I think the theme was laptop diplomacy. But I think, seriously, we're already on the wrist. This is an Apple Watch, and basically, for me, the most important thing it does, if this buzzes, then I know it's important. You know, the phone is already a step further in slowness and volume, and by the time I get to my computer, you know, that's old news. It might be 30 seconds old, but then it's quite old. So the key thing for us is always, if we send out press alerts, those buzz on the watches, there's something very serious going on. For example, we just sent out one before this meeting started. There's a big meeting on the refugee crisis going on in Netherlands tonight, and a special security going on, and then we sent something out. Next to this huge volume I shared with you that we produce ourselves or we get from our partners, we also crawl on the online databases 40,000 articles a day. So imagine this is the Dutch news and information media. We get another 40,000 articles a day and another 10,000 from our international partners. So we produce 600 a day. Get 50,000 additional. This gives you a little bit of an idea about the kind of volume we're talking about. And because this volume goes so fast, I think it's very important for you as an audience maybe to try to understand what it means. It means when something goes, it can go quick and big very quickly. And we also do the history back to 1998. And what does this imply to you and to us? We believe we have a media-centric society, and maybe from being from the media, this is what you want to hear and see. But I think in the Netherlands, and maybe you might have experienced this, we are very media-centric. So there's a lot of publications, there's a lot of articles, there's a lot of television stations, a lot of radio, which means a lot of the debate happens in the media. And this implies that every organization has to become or has to be a media organization. If you're not capable of working with the media, the sheer volume might be difficult to work with if it happens. It also means that for us as media companies, we have to be data companies. These volumes, these systems, we need to be able to work with them, analyze them, and distribute them. But it also means that for every professional in your organization, they have to become a media professional as well, because it's so important to be tuned in. Yes, I will. So this means huge volume, big data, you might have heard it before, and you have to have great tools. Because what happens in this society where the information is shared easily and in big volumes, if you don't have the tools, you might have big crises before you know how to work with it. So yes, there's a great opportunity for sharing information, but there's also a big importance to be alert that when something happens. And to have those tools, I think, is more important than ever. And again, if your watch buzzes, you know, then you need to be afraid. And if your phone buzzes, it's probably somebody calling you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Nispen. Yes, unbiased news, and it goes not only via the computer, but also via the watch now. So you see how much a media company can be an IT company using its media turbine, as you were saying. Next one is the Media Info Group, Mr. Galit Rojan. Rojan, and he is the account manager international relations, and actually MIG is the oldest media monitoring company in the Netherlands. They will celebrate this year, I understand, their 100th anniversary. But I tell you, they have gone with the time. They are not they did not stay in the first year. They are very much adapting themselves. Please, Mr. Roger.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Khalid Rojan from the Media Info Group. I'm a media consultant and also responsible for international relations within the company. Our company, like Mr. Nia said, is celebrating its 100-year anniversary this year. We started out with hand-cut clippings, meaning that we had round tables like these with people with newspapers cutting everything by hand and sending those to our clients. Well, information need has been updated and has changed a lot. We now have fully digitalized news portals in which we upload all the information that we have, and I will give you a short introduction as to how we do this. Well, the first part is media monitoring, and media monitoring is basically our main service in which we monitor, well, different types of media, starting with, of course, print, but also online, radio and television, as well as social media channels. As was explained earlier, there are a lot of these channels, so we have about 130 people who process all the information that we have and that we find in the media based on the search terms that the client has given us. Sorry. Media monitoring is quite changing at the moment, where we used to have client needs where clients were only interested in knowing what was written about them. It has become more important to know why people are writing about them and what are they writing. So this change we call media intelligence. Media intelligence is basically the shift from knowing that you are mentioned to knowing how you are mentioned. It takes a lot of work to get this information properly processed. With the media monitoring, we use, for instance, text recognition programs or software in which keywords, for instance, economics or environmental issues, are monitored and the information is sent to the client. The client then has to know what has to happen with that information. This is where our partners, GMAS, basically step in, because we have our own analysis partners working with us, but we also have GMAS who are perfectly capable of serving you the way you need to be served, which is giving you insight and information, detailed information, on how the media is affecting your country or your relations with the Netherlands, for instance. So this cooperation between the two of us is basically just the start of providing you with the necessary tools to get you to make the right decisions, to see who and where needs to be contacted, and how to express yourself in the media. Our partners at GMAS have used our tools to make reports for specific countries, and as well as, sorry, lost my footing here. They make specific reports per country, and in that report you can see what is written about your country, how it is written, what is the tone of voice, for instance, is there a negative, is there a positive tone of voice, what can you do to respond to that, and how can you as a country or as an embassy or as a press relations work with those people who are writing about you in order to get your message across a different way. We provide, as I mentioned, the tools, and the know-how comes from GMAS, our partners. Basically, in short, that's the cooperation between Media Info Group and GMAS. That's the presentation.
Very good. Thank you very much indeed, and very much within time, yes. Quite clear that you are yourself very much digitalized as well already, because you kept very much to the time schedule. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Rojan. Yes, and as you were saying, how to get the news that is affecting your country and to know about it in the Netherlands, where most of it is in Dutch, that's something which is indeed very much to the core of your activities together with GMAS. The main speaker for this afternoon before the interval is Professor Jan Melissen. He is a senior research fellow at Klingendaal and, amongst many other things, also professor at the University of Antwerp. I always think if he would not have been a scientist, he should have become a diplomat, because his subject is diplomacy in the digital age. Please, Mr. Jan Melissen.
Thank you very much, Eric, for your kind introduction. I shall take up the challenge by trying to be very undiplomatic. It's my great honor, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, to be here this afternoon and to share a few thoughts with you about digital diplomacy. Thanks to the organizers, thanks also to the Ministries of Foreign Affairs of Finland and Belgium, who co-commissioned the report that we have written at Klingendaal about diplomacy in the digital age. Where the question is really, well, what is this all about? And I know there is a lot of expertise in this room, many people representing countries that are experimenting a great deal with this. I just had a little chuckle with the Indian ambassador exchanging ideas about how Mr. Narendra Modi was actually hosting meetings with the top 10 CEOs of technology companies in the United States. It's a topic of great interest, to me and my co-author, Brian Hocking. The report that we've done has been translated into Chinese in the meantime. There will be a book for an American publisher. So we have joined a conversation that is apparently catering for some needs. I'm saying we have joined a conversation because that's how I feel. I feel like a real beginner in a new field where many people are like myself, individuals and organizations trying to come to terms with what it means to them to operate in the digital age. So is it all about social media? If that were the criteria, it's very easy to find two role models. Actually, only last week, one British diplomat, Ambassador Tom Fletcher, received the Internet Oscar, the so-called Lovie Award. Mr. Fletcher, Ambassador Fletcher, has more than 50,000 followers. But of course, every man is meeting his match. I know a Dutch diplomat who's now based in the United States, Alexander Verbeek, who has 71,000 followers. This means the same to me as 10 billion euros on my bank account. I can't make much sense of these figures. Also, Mr. Verbeek is following himself 47,000 people. Now, this looks to me like the sort of digital variant of reciprocity in relations. And what do you do when, as a diplomat, you follow 47,000 people? I have no idea, but one thing is perhaps clear. These two gentlemen have no fear of being exposed, no fear of going out. And that is perhaps part of what diplomacy in the digital age is all about. In an interesting report by the Mercator Foundation in Berlin, by actually the Center on Leadership and Advocacy, one of the conclusions in the report was that diplomats do actually often feel rather insecure, surprisingly, when they are operating in very diverse networks where they no longer have the distinctiveness that they have in their own realm, in their own comfort zone. So these two gentlemen, I guess, Fletcher and Verbeek, are of a different breed. Neither do they fear negative reactions about what they're saying. I looked at Verbeek's account, Twitter feed. Every message has a picture. So there were lots of ors and ahs on my side. But I think he has no fear of negative reactions, and neither does Mr. Fletcher have that. As Richard Stengel, the US Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, recently said in an interview, diplomats, referring to American diplomats, need a thick skin and should not be so afraid of negative reactions. This comes with operating in the digital age. So in this discussion, my starting point is that I would like to exchange ideas with people who speak the same language. I've been fearful of being confronted with people who speak program language, and which is very exclusive. It's very easy to talk about digital for people in a way that excludes large swaths of the population. I think we should talk a language in which we understand one another. Also, digital diplomacy I see as a shorthand for broader change in diplomacy. So what is happening to diplomacy is really the main question for me, and I think your main purpose should be, how does it contribute to the objectives of what you want to achieve? Where does digital come in? How does it contribute to foreign policy? Foreign ministries, would be my contention here, are in the first stage. They're just trying to figure out what it all means to them. Standing in a long tradition of how to do business, they're confronted with a fast-changing environment and these new technologies. So there is skepticism and hype. One could say that's the first stage where we are now. People are embracing and saying, well, it should all be digital. And others say, well, really, this is only another way of doing what we have always done. The second reaction might be gradual acceptance that indeed digitization or digitalization has an impact on diplomacy. And the third reaction would then be in time, mainstreaming of new practices within the organization. And I can imagine that many of you have seen, to draw a parallel, have seen that happening in the field of public diplomacy. At the end of the 20th century, not very long ago, one could still read in diplomatic dictionaries that that was really propaganda, not something for diplomats. Now we have seen how it has been mainstreamed in your organizations, and it's not just the business of some communication experts, but everybody's business. My suspicion is that the same may happen to digital diplomacy. So what is technological change doing to diplomacy? There have been technological revolutions before, and one of them was, of course, the arrival of the telegram when Lord Palmerston famously said, "This is the end of diplomacy." Well, it wasn't. At the time of WikiLeaks, an Italian foreign minister exclaimed exactly the same. If you will forgive me that I forgot his name. But he also said, "This is the end of diplomacy as we know it." So many years after WikiLeaks, we know diplomacy has not disappeared. What we saw at the time of the telegram, the arrival of the telegram, we could see how power was going to headquarters, how diplomacy became more centralized, greater power over the embassies, over the periphery, the possibility to manage embassies better thanks to telegrams. You may reflect on what the effect is of the arrival of social media and the arrival of digital tools. I expect that there is not just a very simple answer, but certainly it may be that in the networks that foreign ministries and embassies are, there is a gradual shift slightly to the periphery from the center, to places where you are. Now, what does complexity invite and new technologies? Certainly vagueness. Vagueness because we have to figure out what it means. And again, a parallel may work. I don't know whether you've heard of this word soft power, but I'm sure you have heard of the word soft power. You may even have used it yourself. And I sense that many people use it without really knowing, particularly politicians, knowing what it exactly means. We see the same with digital. What we also see is what I would call the Nescafe school of people who make instant interpretations of what's going on. And that would be, for instance, an example of that would be what we've seen in the 1990s with the CNN effect, the supposed CNN effect, where instant news was supposedly driving international politics. More recently, with the so-called Arab Spring, I think we've seen the same, a rather overestimation of what technology is doing to international relations. We have to understand technology always, indeed, within its social environment. What is it doing to social relations, and how do social relations between organizations and people pick up these technologies? So in the way I look at these things, I have an interest in how diplomacy is changing, how innovation in diplomacy takes place. I think there is a paradox. And that paradox is that diplomacy in the digital age starts with understanding diplomacy offline. So you have to understand change in diplomacy and then see how the digital age builds on that. But that things are going on is very clearly, and as the gentleman before me talking about the media, I think made clear directly and indirectly, one of the very basic functions of diplomacy is being tested, information gathering. Information gathering is so much easier technically, but at the same time, processing and analyzing information has become an enormous challenge. So here enter the newsrooms of the Dutch Foreign Ministry, the data scientists, and external agencies, because really, with just a few people in the embassy, it's a very complex landscape where we're trying to find our feet. Newness in diplomacy, then, I think has a lot to do with today, with new communication technology. And we've seen how some activities are actually that were peripheral in diplomacy have moved to the center, some functions of diplomacy, the consular function, public diplomacy. It was all seen as peripheral of the work of foreign ministries, has moved right to the center. And we can see in these two areas how fundamental technology also is. Public diplomacy is a field where we can see that technology, use of new media, use of digital tools, gives enormous instruments to understand a lot more of what's going on in other countries. It also enhances enormously the penetration capacity of embassies into foreign societies, even of formerly closed societies. Consular is about service delivery. It's perhaps the field where most clearly we can see that digital tools can help people who want to be helped here and now. And they want to be helped by real people with a human face, but they also want to be helped by people who understand the challenge of modern technology and who are as technologically savvy as they are themselves in society outside your organization. So that's where your challenge is, and that's where the interface is. But also in negotiation, I think, the hard core of diplomacy, one could easily dismiss and say, well, technology has no impact on negotiation, but I think there are many examples of where we see that in one way or another, the social media play a role, are visible. And to start with, what has become very important in negotiations is the framing of what negotiations are about. And that framing does not take place in smoke-filled rooms where men, like in the interwar period, were negotiating treaties. No, it's now a place outside where men and women and organizations of all types are trying to frame what the negotiation is about. And that is where digital technology also comes in. So it's no good to juxtapose, would be my opinion, digital and non-digital, juxtapose analog and digital. And one could draw a parallel here where some students of international politics were talking about the demise of the state compared with the rise of non-state actors. I think we can see very clearly that the state is here to stay, but that the state is involved in a new kind of game in a much more hybrid world of state and non-state actors, which is also a much more hybrid world in a communication sense. Old media and new media, one feeding into the other, and it's your task to find your way in that complex landscape. Two features of diplomacy in the digital age, as I would see it. One, it is embeddedness in society. I've already commented on public diplomacy and consular affairs. Society becomes a resource, and that's also where digital tools can be used. We can see in humanitarian crisis assistance how what people know, and also in consular assistance, what people know actually helps government in crafting solutions. The second dynamic is a network dynamic where there is an internal one, where the balance may shift towards more power, more importance of the embassy. Secondly, that it's much more important to work with external partners. And that's doing all sorts of things to diplomacy where digital is also coming in. Information used to be, in its most traditional sense, power for the individual diplomat. In the digital age, it's power, but it's also something you share. You share in a network. In that network, you count, if you master the technologies, that your counterparts in the network count. In the network, the rules of the game are not the rules of the game of diplomacy. It's not the organization that you represent, but your ideas, the ideas that you have, the knowledge that you have, that contribute to the network, that you need in turn to find solutions for your issues. So optimizing the network is important. Network diplomacy, I would say, networking is not just something diplomats do. No, it's become the foundational basis of diplomacy today. And it also means optimizing your internal network, where, again, digital comes in. I don't know how in your foreign ministry one job is handed over to his or her successor, but in many foreign ministries, this is, let me put it mildly, not extremely well organized. And I don't know how in your internal, in your foreign ministry, how you find knowledge that you need. Do you have a customer relation management system? Or issues where digital technology, digital tools will, sooner rather than later, give answers to organizations that are so rich in knowledge like yours, but that have one big issue, how to get it out of the organization and how to get the knowledge from outside your organization and use that knowledge for the purposes of your own organization. There's actually, right at this moment, in the digital sphere, an interesting little polemic going on conducted by the Lowy Institute in Australia and Sydney about what digital diplomacy is, whether the Australians are doing this well, and what it is really for. I can really recommend that to you, as there are so many debates about this going on right now. Now, diplomacy can be used for all sorts of purposes, and I would say that that applies in the same way to digital diplomacy. So it can be soft, it can be hard, it can be beneficial, and it can be really nasty. And I think depending on where you live, you see one phase of digital diplomacy or the other. When you think of relations between Russia and Europe, or when you think of relations in Northeast Asia between South Korea, Japan, and China, you see more of the nasty phase of digital diplomacy. When you think of the humanitarian operations that I alluded to, or one could think of development cooperation, ODA, one can see that there is enormous potential that we have to tap into, to study, to learn how to use, to make use of digital diplomacy for foreign policy purposes. Digital diplomacy can be soft. It can be about the empowerment of the individual. Digital diplomacy can be hard, and here one often thinks of the subject of big data. Big data that harbor enormous capacity for foreign ministries. One can just think of what you can know about other nations, but also what you can know about negotiations and the history of negotiations, your own positions in the history of negotiations, and so on. So there is enormous potential there, but of course there are also negative sides to it, a bit of an Orwellian idea that big data is not just beneficial. Certainly they cannot help us to predict the future, and in my mind there is a risk with big data that the data scientists, the number crunchers, are taking over from people who are taking sensible decisions. You can imagine a situation where people say, well, the data speak. It may seem common sense. It may seem common sense to you to decide for A, but the data say that you have to go in the direction of B. So coming closer to the end of my talk, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and otherwise, please cut me off. Coming closer to the end of my talk, let's focus again briefly on social media. Is it just superficial? Is it just like Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Verbeek? I'm not saying they're superficial, not at all, but just all over the place with pictures and messages and thousands of followers. Well, briefly about the followers, probably it was important, of course, is who is following you. And many non-governmental organizations are doing research into whom they are following and whom by whom they are followed. So it's perhaps here we see that the diplomat comes a bit closer to the intelligence officer. Excellence in the digital age, we also find outside the state. The International Committee on the Red Cross is well known for its highly sophisticated digital strategies. Among international organizations. The World Bank is considered as one of the leaders. So what I try to do in learning about this subject is shopping everywhere, indeed also going to business, because I realize that businessmen, they have a gun against their head. If they do something wrong and it goes digital, they see their profits going down. Think of Volkswagen. So some people may feel in a much more acute sense than diplomats do, what's the potential or what's the risk of digital. Volunteer-based organizations go digital because they know that's where people are, that's they know where volunteers are. So social media may also be more than just be a superficial pastime. Although admittedly, many individual diplomats, like any other human being, I think, are trying to find their feet, are trying to find their voice in these new types of media. But they have been, you can see how in different functions of diplomacy, we see that social media are there. Just a couple of examples from our report. MH370 went down, and immediately the whole issue went viral. Went viral to the extent that the Chinese government started blaming the Malaysian government. The Ebola crisis led to an acrimonious exchange between a non-governmental organization and an international organization, Médecins Sans Frontières International and the World Health Organization. The Nepal earthquake, the Dutch are proud that they've got their act together. They went on Twitter, like so many other countries, and they very soon found who were the Dutch people in Nepal and where they were. So it shows the potential in helping people in service delivery. In the most traditional of negotiations, the nuclear negotiations over Iran, we saw that the Iranian foreign minister was using Twitter to communicate to his, using social media to communicate to his domestic constituency. To sum it up all with the words of US Secretary of State John Kerry, digital diplomacy is diplomacy, period. And that's the challenge, to find our way. How do individuals find their way? As I said at the beginning, I'm not a media person. I don't represent a state. So I'm also allowed, I've been assured by our chairman, to say some provocative things. I shall conclude on that note. Is diplomacy really the norm? How digitized are diplomats really? I don't have an answer to that question. I have many stops in the months ahead at organizations and in countries where I hope to learn more about this. But what's interesting, I think, is that some norms are breaking down. In the rather conservative culture of foreign ministries, making mistakes could be lethal. Now we say that people are allowed to make mistakes. There is a realization that there is no escape from making mistakes when you are in the digital domain. Interesting form of cultural change. At the same time, I see political correctness around. How could one possibly dare and say, I'm not in the social media when everybody's talking about it? So it's a good subject for lunchtime talk. There is a little bit of political correctness around. But my hunch is that many diplomats, when it comes to Twitter, analogous to LinkedIn, where you can easily see this, may actually be following diplomats. So how does it mean that diplomats go out of their own sphere or stay in their own sphere when they are using these kinds of media? And I think very often there may also be very good reasons to be anonymous as a practitioner in the social media. One can easily see why this would be the case in the consular field, where you're really the cold face defending the interests of people in distress. It's better to be anonymous there. There are other reasons, and that is that digital accounts that may seem totally passive accounts are in a way very active accounts, because diplomats are using them to get a wealth of information at their fingertips that was not there before. So Twitter is used passively, just sticking to this medium. Some people say Twitter is the medium of diplomacy. But then there is an Israeli scholar, Ilan Manor, he's now at Oxford, who has done research into the work of foreign ministries, and one of his conclusions is that foreign ministries as institutions are mainly still in broadcast mode. And again, here one could make the comparison with public diplomacy. which has evolved from broadcasting to dialoguing to co-creation, to use that fashionable word of cultural relations. Foreign ministries may still, he maintains, are still very much behaving in a digital world like analog species. But then, on a positive note, I see that there is actually also great potential. When we see in the human rights field, with a more campaign style of diplomacy, what digital media can do is quite phenomenal. There are examples like the UK initiative on the prevention of sexual violence in conflicts, which has been a very digital operation. The Dutch have been doing things on LGBT rights, where digital work has been very, very important. Sweden, standing up for vulnerable persons, has a campaign called Midwives for All, that is also a very much a digitally based campaign. Not going into that, but here we perhaps are moving from digitized diplomacy to digital diplomacy. Initiatives that are not taken towards the digital age, but that are born in the digital age. And with that, I would like to close on this very positive note, because your question is really, what can digital diplomacy do for you? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Mills. Going from broadcasting to dialogue to co-creation, very clear indeed the phases that diplomacy goes through. Particularly you mentioned the consular affairs, which offer possibility for going digital. And I know that some embassies do have already the possibility of getting your visa to visiting the country just by internet. So you don't have to go there anymore, but you just can do it in your own home after you're on your computer. I would actually not try and summarize, but one thing which really sticked to me so far as the contents of your lecture is concerned is, I think today's diplomacy is about instant assessment of instant news. And of course, you do make a mistake then from time to time. You can't prevent that, but you should make those mistakes as little as possible and as few times as possible. Thank you very much indeed. Also for the fact that you have been able to comprise a lecture, which is normally 45 minutes, into half of it, and still you had the same contents. Thank you very much indeed. Before I propose a short break, I have to apologize that we have tried to put everybody according to the hierarchy and protocol order, but I understand we have not been able to succeed entirely in that. We apologize for that, but everybody is seated now, and the ones who want to be more in front, after the interval, they can come more in front. I can't prevent myself from mentioning one remark, but it's mostly unfortunately for the Dutch people than for the foreigners. I am still of the age that when you heard about social media, you thought that was Margriet and Libel, which is two ladies' magazines in the Netherlands which are being printed. So, but I have adapted myself rather quickly after that, I can imagine, I can assure you. All right, I propose a 10-minute break, just to stretch your legs. And what I'm going to propose also, Professor Melis and the other speakers will remain after the break also here. We have a panel. I would like to propose, I did not discuss it with them, but I would like to propose that the panel reacts 5 minutes on what is being has been said before, and that immediately then afterwards, the floor is all for you, because it's your questions which will help us, and hopefully yourself as well, to adapt yourself to the digital age. So 10-minute break, and we see each other back here again.